Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
And I agree with you when you talk about balanced trade. I agree 100%.
Texas cattle feeder Robbie Kirkland testifying before a House Trade Subcommittee.
Some countries have identified United States agriculture as a target for retaliation. We've seen that. That's not ideal for farmers and ranchers, but it's also bad for global consumers, so those consumers that are buying our goods as well. However, tariffs can be an effective tool. We've seen that. We've seen it resolve serious problems and massive trade barriers, and we'll work with Congress and the President to accomplish those goals. And so we understand those things. We understand there may be some headwinds, but we're there ready to dig in and get after it.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Due to the success of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, most of the North American cattle fed and processed capacity is in the United States.
Robbie Kirkland with Kirkland Feed Yard in Vega, Texas, testifying before a House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Trade.
Cattle imports represent 2% of our overall cattle herd and only 6.5% of our total cattle beef harvest. Cattle imports fill seasonal lows in the feed yards and packing plants and keep them running at optimal capacity, especially in the Southwest. Demand for U.S. beef is on the rise because of its strong reputation and safety, quality, and positive eating experience.
Kathleen Clausen is a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center on how agreements are off track.
In recent decades, the executive branch agencies have concluded hundreds of trade-related agreements without clear congressional authorization or approval. I refer to these as trade executive agreements, given the lack of congressional involvement. Some colleagues also refer to them as skinny or mini deals, since they have been narrowly focused on one or a small set of trade issues, but they are not small in their impact. You'll be familiar with several of these from the last 8 years, such as the handful of deals concluded with Japan and a wide-ranging agreement with Taiwan. Those are just a sample. In total, the United States maintains trade agreements that fall short of comprehensive FTAs with 130 countries.
Kirkland uses a real-life example with Australia and how trade isn't fair.
For the last 20 years, Australia has sold roughly $29 billion worth of beef to American consumers. In that same time, we have not exported and sold $1 worth of beef, fresh beef, in the country of Australia. That's a clear-cut differential. Australians have exhausted all their approval processes over the last 20 years, and we believe in science-based protocols, and we don't believe that there's any science-based protocols there. We fully believe that U.S. deserves full access to the Australian market.
The chairman of the House Budget Committee is also a member of the House Ways and Means Trade Subcommittee. From Texas, Jody Arrington.
Let's talk about making American trade great. It doesn't work when we have an average trade rate of 3.3% and the 20 largest economies, developed countries, who we compete with and trade with, have twice that rate. And when you look at agriculture, I think our average rate is around 5%, but the 20 largest economies have three times that rate. How are we supposed to accept the fact that there is such a thing as free trade without fair trade? We're simply attempting, and this president is attempting for the second time, because we lost a lot of the ground we made up in his first term, to reset those relationships such that we're playing by the same set of rules.
One agreement the administration had been working on was with the UK.
British consumers, we've seen, they love U.S. beef. It is highly restrictive due to small quotas and tariffs.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Last month, this committee examined two far-reaching and consequential laws, the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act, both of which have been fundamentally transformed from their original purpose, scope, and intent through endless lawsuits and administrative agency actions, including guidance documents, rulemakings, and internal protocols.
Harriet Hageman is a representative from Wyoming and is the chair of a House Natural Resources Subcommittee.
As I said during our hearing, this legislative body must do a better job of writing laws. It is Congress's responsibility to be clear, concise, specific, and unambiguous when defining the authorities granted to federal agencies. Today we are considering four bills, of which two take direct aim at addressing and resolving the concerns that were raised last month regarding the ESA. Our first bill, the Pet and Livestock Protection Act of 2025, exposes the ESA failures, misinterpretations, and misapplications we have lived with for far too long. For decades, the federal government, states, tribes, and private conservation partners have worked to recover the gray wolf populations, and they have been highly successful in doing so. Despite this achievement, however, the Fish and Wildlife Service's recognition that our gray wolf populations have not only recovered, but thrived under both Republican and Democrat administrations have been met with controversy. The endless litigation surrounding the delisting of a recovered species like the gray wolf only proves the point that the ESA must be reformed. We must find a way to end this doom loop of recovery, delisting, litigation, court intervention, relisting, the wasting of more resources on a recovered species, another attempt at delisting, and then starting it all over again. Which brings me to our second bill, ESA Amendments Act of 2025, sponsored by Chairman Westerman. This bill makes critical changes to the ESA to provide regulatory certainty, transparency, and accountability. This is done through the inclusion of definitions and parameters of previously ambiguous terms and requiring the service to implement incremental and objective recovery goals for listed species that are coupled with tangible regulatory relief as such goals are accomplished. I want to thank Chairman Westerman for once again leading the effort to reform the ESA and start us on a course of sound resource and species management. This legislation is a serious step towards a model of endangered species conservation that empowers local landowners and decision makers. We are also considering legislation sponsored by Congresswoman Green, the Gulf of America Act of 2025, which aims to codify part of President Trump's Executive Order 14172, restoring names that honor American greatness. The bill also ensures consistency in our statutes, maps, and regulations by updating any reference by reflecting uniformity with any reference to the Gulf.
California Representative Jared Huffman.
This Republican majority thinks that it works for President Trump, as opposed to being an independent branch of government that serves as a check on power. And so we see endless attempts to curry favor, to kiss up. And, of course, the quintessence of that is the bill before us today to rename the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America, something that was actually floated as a joke by comedian Stephen Colbert back in 2010. But now, apparently, the joke is on us. Look, we should be talking about the mass firings of federal employees, facility closures, chaotic government takeovers by Elon Musk and his Doge tech bros, things that are leaving agencies unable to deliver essential services from essential public safety to mitigating wildfire risk.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
One of the silver linings when we talk about the increases or gradual increases in financial stress is to remind people that despite some of the stress that we've seen, despite the limited profits, a 5.5 percentage point increase in interest rates over the span of the past two and a half years, delinquency rates on farm loans have still been exceedingly low.
Nate Kaufman is with the Kansas City Federal Reserve, speaking recently at USDA's Ag Outlook Forum.
This chart goes back only to 2000, but you can see here that it's actually even quite a bit lower than where we would have been in 2014, and that having been a really good year in agriculture leading up to 2014, a series of good years in agriculture. So we haven't yet seen strong increases in delinquency rates. But as the chart on the right would suggest, there's some other indicators that you could look at to say, well, just because delinquency rates are low, that doesn't necessarily give us the best forward-looking picture of what might happen. You might expect that every lender is going to do what they can to avoid a loan going into default. You don't want that to happen, so you're going to do some other things to try to prevent it from getting there. One of the things that you might do is that you might restructure a loan. If there's some equity that an operation has, let's say in land, then when you're going in for a loan renewal, a lender might look at what assets you have and figure out a way to restructure a loan to give you more flexibility to extend that payment out over time and maybe take some collateral from that asset that you were able to offer. So the chart on the right shows a bit more of a cautionary tale, which is to suggest that as we've followed conditions the past 2 years, looking at that light blue line, these measures of renewals and extensions have continued to increase. So again, suggesting that there has been some amount of pressure that would require or lead producers to want or need to renew those credit lines when maybe previously they would have paid them down or perhaps extend some of the loans a bit further than what they might have. And this chart also showing overlaid with that the measure of repayment rates that I alluded to earlier. One of the other things to keep in mind, and going back to my earlier comment on inflation, is that it's not just about the expenses that an operation might observe with respect to farming, but also thinking about household expenses and what inflation looks like there. So this is another thing to keep in mind, especially as it relates to conversations with lenders that are trying to take a fairly holistic approach of the level of risk that one of their borrowers might have, is thinking about both capital spending on the farm, but also household spending. So as you can imagine, when there has been more financial pressure, you have seen this measure of capital spending decline a bit. That's the light blue line. But at the same time, household spending, as we're all experiencing inflation and have been for the past couple of years, hasn't been declining to the same extent. So it's the combination of things ultimately here that lenders are interested in when they're thinking about primarily that measure that I mentioned before, loan repayment. The other part of this that I alluded to at the very beginning as well is interest rates. And this probably goes without saying, these are some measures of interest rates for both farm operating loans and farm real estate loans, that this represents another headwind for those producers, obviously, that are going to be more significantly leveraged or financed. For some producers, they may also be refinancing some amount of their purchases that previously had an interest rate that was around 3%, that now, as you can see in this chart, it might be financed at something that's like 8 and 8.5%, especially if we're talking about land. I'll keep coming back to land because land tends to be one of these longer-term assets that doesn't necessarily reprice every year. You might not actually see the full implication of interest rates on farmland until 3, 5, maybe even more years later. And so that's where the lag effect associated with interest rates can matter.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
First and foremost, I'm confident we will build upon the historic trade negotiation successes of President Trump's first term.
Chairman of a House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Trade, from Nebraska, Adrian Smith.
In 4 years, the Trump administration was able to fundamentally alter the trajectory of U.S. trade policy through new agreements with our top trading partners, including the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA, as we know, the China Phase One Agreement, and the United States-Japan Trade Agreement. These agreements tore down a litany of tariff and non-tariff barriers facing American farmers, manufacturers, and service providers to level the playing field for American industry and workers.
Linda Sanchez is a representative from California, the ranking member on that trade subcommittee.
As the ranking member of the trade subcommittee, I want to see new trade agreements with partners committed to advancing worker rights, protecting the environment, providing access to medicines, defending human rights, safeguarding our intellectual property, fighting against corruption, and creating the conditions for fair competition. But this cannot be done without a trusted negotiating partner in the White House, one who thinks solely about what's best for the American people and its workers, and a Republican Party ready to stand with us to protect the Constitution and the rule of law. Since our last trade subcommittee hearing only a month ago, President Trump has recklessly thrown around tariff authority against our closest trading partners.
A witness testifying on behalf of agriculture, Texas cattle feeder Robbie Kirkland.
The United States has some of the safest and most efficient practices, production practices in the world, and we utilize science and technology to produce 18% of the world's beef. with 6% of the world's cattle, while generating only 2% of the U.S. greenhouse gases. Consumers at home and abroad trust U.S. beef. 85% of U.S. beef is consumed by Americans, but there are certain cuts and products like short ribs, tongues, livers, and other organ meats with strong consumer demand in Asia and Latin America.
Kirkland calling out the lack of trade priorities over the past 4 years.
But over the past few years, the U.S. government has done little to expand our footprint abroad, while our competitors aggressively secured access to the markets, and we need to reengage and level the playing field. Unfortunately, U.S. beef faces a 50% tariff in Thailand, a 30% tariff in Vietnam, and many non-tariff barriers in Australia, Europe, and China. We need Congress and the Trump administration to ensure fair trade in these markets while securing new agreements with allies like the United Kingdom.
Forget free trade. What about fair trade? Jody Arrington is a representative from Texas, chairman of the Budget Committee.
You know, I can't imagine the Texas Tech Red Raiders taking on the Arkansas Hogs and let the Arkansas Razorbacks shoot layups for their free throws or pick up the ball and run with it instead of dribbling. I mean, can you ever imagine watching a competition where there were two sets of rules? Now, we'd still beat them, no question, under any set of rules and circumstances. But anyway, it just seems to me that it's un-American to not fight for our manufacturers, producers, and workers to simply have an even playing field. And I imagine whether it's Ms. Sanchez's district or mine, we'll whip the competition every day and twice on Sunday. We have the best technology, the best operators and producers.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Included in today's hearing is the ESA Amendments Act of 2025. This is a bill that would reauthorize and amend the Endangered Species Act for the first time in nearly 40 years.
Arkansas Representative Bruce Westerman is chairman of the Natural Resources Committee and the only forester in Congress.
The bill is the product of many years of work with many members of this committee and countless experts and stakeholders. Madam Chair, I've been on record with my thoughts on the Endangered Species Act many times in this committee. It is a well-intentioned law that has been hijacked by litigation and executive overreach to the detriment of the species it's supposed to help recover and the communities its regulations impact. And I realize this is a sensitive topic. I realize that emotions run high when we talk about the Endangered Species Act. And I think there's probably more agreement on both sides of the dais than we might would admit to. And I was just listening to Representative Hoyle's opening statement. She said, we have a biodiversity crisis. I don't necessarily disagree with that. She said, when species recover, everyone benefits. I totally agree with that. But the Endangered Species Act is broken, and if we just leave it like it is, we're not going to get any better benefits out of it. So putting forward legislation that promotes conservation of habitat and therefore the recovery of listed species has been a major goal of mine as chairman of the Resources Committee. As Gifford Pinchot, the famous 20th century conservationist, once said, unless we practice conservation, those who come after us will have to pay the price of misery, degradation, and failure for the progress and prosperity of our day. However, I also believe that we must approach species protection with common sense. Working together, we can find solutions that protect our wildlife and allow our farmers, ranchers, and businesses to thrive. The ESA has not been reauthorized by Congress since 1988. Since then, almost 1,200 of the over 1,700 ESA-listed species have been added to the list. These new listings, along with countless other agency rulemakings, have created new challenges. Congress must examine these actions to determine if the law is being implemented as Congress originally intended. First and foremost, it is time that Congress brings the ESA back to its original intent, which is recovering listed species to the point where they no longer need to be protected, as its current dismal 3% recovery rate is wholly unacceptable. H.R. 1897 prioritizes recovery in several ways. First, it builds greater incentives into the ESA by pairing species recovery goals with regulatory relief. Second, the bill provides regulatory certainty from critical habitat designations to private landowners who are investing in conservation. Third, the bill would prohibit judicial review during the statutory 5-year monitoring period after a species is delisted, preventing frivolous litigation that can often serve as an impediment to recovery efforts. H.R. 1897 would also streamline the ESA permitting process by removing redundant requirements, focusing agency resources where Congress intended, and providing retrospective review of agency permitting actions. H.R. 1897 also contains provisions that address several issues that this subcommittee has examined in the past. These include language to prevent the ESA being exploited to justify destructive regulations like vessel speed restrictions, and language to address the verdict in the Maine lobsterman case by preventing in statute the services from having a bias towards listed species during ESA consultations. After more than 50 years, it's time that we make changes to bring the ESA into the 21st century. I'm thankful to everyone that has contributed to the development of this legislation, and I'm looking forward to discussing it in further detail today.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We have asked some long-running questions. There are questions we've asked year in and year out that give us this longitudinal, long-run perspective of what people think.
Brad Lubin is an Extension Ag Specialist with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln on the Nebraska Rural Poll.
And if you generally ask a person, are you better off? Are we generally getting better off? Well, the continued economic growth or growth in standard of living, we generally might expect that we're all getting better off over time. Of course, individuals face different circumstances, and so some people might feel worse off. Well, we generally are, more of us feel better off than worse off as compared to, in this case, 5 years ago. That's our reference point. But a smaller percentage feel better off versus worse off than in some previous years, and it's been going down for a couple years. And if we think of the reference point, in this case, 5 years ago for the 2024 poll was 2019. That was before COVID. Mm-hmm. That was before all the contentiousness of recent political elections and rhetoric and so forth. We've had a lot of sort of general social concern and anxiety in the past few years that perhaps it's not as surprising that we've hurt that statistic a little bit. We generally still feel the gains over time and expect that we're better off compared to where we've been or better off compared to our parents and so forth, but a little bit weaker result this time around.
In addition to getting the general pulse of the rural communities, they also look at housing.
We ask housing as part of a long set of questions, really, that we ask about sort of local community services and community amenities. And housing is one of those factors that probably has scored the weakest of that over time. A decline in satisfaction, meaning a lack of quality or a lack of affordability, or even just simply a lack of availability. Rural housing has been an issue. And, you know, while it's outside the scope of this poll, we know that there have been other studies and other programs focused on rural housing and how do you attract new residents? How do you make your community appealing to future growth? Housing is always at the foundation of some of those things. If you can't find quality housing, if you can't find affordable housing, if you can't find opportunities to grow or build, it's hard to want to go look in a rural community. So housing is one of those issues that where we see concerns, and we know it already. This just really confirms the need for it and attention to how we deal with housing in rural places.
Another concern is growing polarization.
Well, civil discourse is certainly, we have more of a topical focus on, in this poll, we had a topical focus on what do we know about civil discourse at the moment. We don't have the same longitudinal analysis over time, but the results definitely say that we have concerns about civil discourse and concerns that sort of the ability to work through issues, the ability to talk to neighbors or even talk to family. All of those issues are bigger concerns now than they've been in, at least compared to any sort of benchmark. They're big concerns. And so that's part of the function of the rural poll itself, is to raise awareness and raise understanding of issues. That helps the discussion that leads to maybe policy action or local community efforts. Well, that requires civil discourse. It requires civic engagement, and a lack of is really a problem to work through in local society.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We do appreciate what President Trump did in his first term. He opened some doors. He opened doors in China where we hadn't traded for 20 years, possibly. Over the last 4 years, there has been a just not as much aggression there. And so it's time to step up to the plate, in our opinion.
Texas cattle feeder Robbie Kirkland.
It needs to be science-based. We know that there's going to be restrictions. We know that sometimes there's going to be retaliatory tariffs. We do understand that. I know us as a company and our family, we understand that in the agriculture business. And do we like it? No, not necessarily. But we do understand for our next generation that's coming up, our fourth generation of family farmers that are starting to come into our business today, we're going to have to go through a little bit of pain to get to the spot where that next round of trade and everything is prosperous for the next generation.